It was the last dream I had in what I now think of as my Manderley series, the culminating dream. It was made even worse, I suppose, by the unrelieved blackness to which I awoke. It started like the others. I'm walking up the lane, listening to the crickets and the loons, looking mostly at the darkening slot of sky overhead. I reach the driveway, and here something has changed. Someone has put a little sticker on the Sarah Laughs sign. I lean closer and see it's a radio station sticker. WBLM, it says. 102.9, Portland's rock and roll blimp. From the sticker, I look back up into the sky, and there is Venus. I wish on her as I always do. I wish for Joanna with the dank and vaguely tremendous smell of the lake in my nose. Something lumbers in the woods, rattling old leaves and breaking a branch. It sounds big. Better get down there, a voice in my head tells me. Something has taken out a contract on you, Michael. A 3-book contract, and that's the worst kind. I can't move. I can never move. I can only stand here. I've got walker's block. But that's just talk. I can walk. This time I can walk. I am delighted. I have had a major breakthrough. In the dream, I think, this changes everything. This changes everything. Down the driveway, I walk, deeper and deeper into the clean but sour smell of pine, stepping over some of the fallen branches, kicking others out of the way. I raise my hand to brush the damp hair off my forehead and see the little scratch running across the back of it. I stop to look at it, curious. No time for that, the dream voice says. Get down there. You've got a book to write. I can't write, I reply. That part's over. I'm on the back 40 now. No, the voice says. There is something relentless about it that scares me. You had writer's walk, not writer's block. And as you can see, it's gone. Now hurry up and get down there. I'm afraid, I tell the voice. Afraid of what? Well, what if Mrs. Danvers is down there? The voice doesn't answer. It knows I'm not afraid of Rebecca De Winter's housekeeper. She's just a character in an old book, nothing but a bag of bones. So I begin walking again. I have no choice, it seems, but at every step my terror increases, and by the time I'm halfway down to the shadowy, sprawling bulk of the log house, fear has sunk into my bones like fever. Something is wrong here. Something is all twisted up. I'll run away, I think. I'll run back the way I came. Like the gingerbread man, I'll run. Run all the way back to Derry, if that's what it takes, and I'll never come here anymore. Except I can hear slobbering breath behind me in the growing gloom and padding footsteps. The thing in the woods is now the thing in the driveway. It's right behind me. If I turn around, the sight of it will knock the sanity out of my head in a single roundhouse slap. Something with red eyes, something slumped and hungry. The house is my only hope of safety. I walk on. The crowding bushes clutch like hands. In the light of a rising moon, the moon has never risen before in this dream, but I have never stayed in it this long before. The rustling leaves look like sardonic faces. I see winking eyes, smiling mouths. Below me are the black windows of the house, and I know that there will be no power when I get inside. The storm has knocked the power out. I will flick the light switch up and down, until something reaches out and takes my wrist and pulls me like a lover deeper into the dark. I am 3/4 of the way down the driveway now. I can see the railroad tie steps leading down to the lake. And I can see the float out there on the water, a black square in a track of moonlight. Bill Dean has put it out. I can also see an oblong something lying at the place where the driveway ends at the stoop. There has never been such an object before. What can it be? Another 2 or 3 steps, and I know. It is a coffin, the one Frank Arlen dickered for, because, he said, the mortician was trying to stick it to me. It is Joe's coffin, and lying on its side with the top partway open, enough for me to see it's empty. I think I want to scream. I think I mean to turn around and run back up the driveway. I will take my chances with the thing behind me. But before I can, the back door of Sarah Laugh's opens and a terrible figure comes darting out into the growing darkness. It is human, this figure, and yet it's not. It is a crumpled white thing with baggy arms upraised. There is no face where its face should be, and yet it is shrieking in a glottal, loon-like voice. It is Joanna, I realize. She was able to escape her coffin, but not her winding shroud. She is all tangled up in it. How hideously speedy this creature is. It doesn't drift as one imagines ghosts drifting, but races across the stoop toward the driveway. It has been waiting down here during all the dreams when I had been frozen, and now that I have finally been able to walk down, it means to have me. I will scream when it wraps me in its silk arms. Of course, I will scream when I smell its rotting, bug-rattled flesh and see its dark, staring eyes through the fine weave of the cloth. I will scream as the sanity leaves my mind forever. I will scream, but there is no one out here to hear me. Only the loons will hear me. I have come again to Manderley, and this time I will never leave. The shrieking white thing reached for me, and I woke up on the floor of my bedroom, crying out in a cracked, horrified voice and slamming my head repeatedly against something. How long before I finally realized I was no longer asleep, that I wasn't at Sarah Laugh's? How long before I realized that I had fallen out of bed at some point and had crawled across the room in my sleep, that I was on my hands and knees in a corner, butting my head against the place where the walls came together, doing it over and over again like a lunatic in an asylum? I didn't know, couldn't know, not with the power out and the bedside clock dead. I know that at first I couldn't move out of the corner because it felt safer than the wider room would have done. And I know that for a long time the dream's force held me, even after waking up. Mostly, I imagine, because I couldn't turn on a light and dispel its power. I was afraid that if I crawled out of my corner, the white thing would burst out of my bathroom, shrieking its dead shriek, eager to finish what it had started. I know I was shivering all over, and that I was cold and wet from the waist down, because my bladder had let go. I stayed there in the corner, gasping and wet, staring into the darkness, wondering if you could have a nightmare powerful enough in its imagery to drive you insane. I thought then, and think now, that I almost found out on that night in late March. At last I felt able to crawl back to my bed. Halfway across the floor, I pulled off my wet pajama pants, and when I did that, I got disoriented. What followed was a miserable and surreal 5 minutes, or perhaps it was only two, in which I crawled aimlessly back and forth in my familiar bedroom, bumping into stuff and moaning each time I hit something with a blind, flailing hand. Each thing I touched at first seemed like that awful white thing. Nothing I touched felt like anything I knew. With the reassuring green numerals of the bedside clock gone and my sense of direction temporarily lost, I could have been crawling around a mosque in Addis Ababa. At last I ran shoulder first into the bed. I stood up, yanked the pillowcase off the extra pillow, and wiped my groin and upper legs with it. Then I crawled back into bed, pulled the blankets up, and lay there shivering, listening to the steady tick of sleet on the windows. There was no sleep for me for the rest of that night, and the dream didn't fade as dreams usually do upon waking. I lay on my side, the shivers slowly subsiding, thinking of her coffin lying there in the driveway, thinking that it made a kind of mad sense. Joe had loved Sarah, and if she were to haunt any place, it would be there. But why would she want to hurt me? Why would my Joe ever want to hurt me? I could think of no reason. Somehow the time passed, and there came a moment when I realized that the air had turned a dark shade of gray. The shapes of the furniture loomed in it like sentinels in fog. That was a little better. That was more like it. I would light the kitchen wood stove, I decided, and make strong coffee, begin the work of getting this behind me. I swung my legs out of bed and raised my hand to brush my sweat-damp hair off my forehead. I froze with the hand in front of my eyes. I must have scraped it while I was crawling, disoriented in the dark and trying to find my way back to bed. There was a shallow, clotted cut across the back, just below the knuckles. Once, when I was 16, a plane went supersonic directly over my head. I was walking in the woods when it happened, thinking of some story I was going to write, perhaps, or how great it would be if Doreen Fournier weakened some Friday night and let me take off her panties while we were parked at the end of Cushman Road. In any case, I was traveling far roads in my own mind, and when that boom went off, I was caught totally by surprise. I went flat on the leafy ground with my hands over my head and my heart drumming crazily, sure I'd reached the end of my life and while I was still a virgin. In my 40 years, that was the only thing which equaled the final dream of the Manderley series for utter terror. I lay on the ground, waiting for the hammer to fall, and when 30 seconds or so passed and no hammer did fall, I began to realize it had just been some jet jockey from the Brunswick Naval Air Station, too eager to wait until he was out over the Atlantic before going to Mach 1. But, holy shit, whoever could have guessed it would be so loud? I got slowly to my feet, and as I stood there with my heart finally slowing down, I realized I wasn't the only thing that had been scared witless by that sudden clear sky boom. For the first time in my memory, the little patch of woods behind our house in Prout's Neck was entirely silent. I stood there in a dusty bar of sunlight, crumbled leaves all over my T-shirt and jeans, holding my breath, listening. I had never heard a silence like it. Even on a cold day in January, the woods are usually full of conversation. At last a finch sang. There were 2 or 3 seconds of silence, and then a jay replied. Another 2 or 3 seconds went by, and then a crow added his 2 cents worth. A woodpecker began to hammer for grubs. A chipmunk bumbled through some underbrush on my left. A minute after I had stood up, the woods were fully alive with little noises again. It was back to business as usual, and I continued with my own. I never forgot that unexpected boom, though, nor the deathly silence which followed it. I thought of that June day often in the wake of the nightmare, and there was nothing so remarkable in that. Things had changed somehow, or could change. But first comes silence, while we assure ourselves that we are still unhurt and that the danger, if there was danger, is gone. Derry was shut down for most of the following week, anyway. Ice and high winds caused a great deal of damage during the storm, and a sudden 20-degree plunge in the temperatures afterward made the digging out hard and the cleanup slow. Added to that, the atmosphere after a March storm is always dour and pessimistic. We get them up this way every year, and 2 or 3 in April for good measure if we're not lucky, but we never seem to expect them. Every time we get clouded, we take it personally. On a day toward the end of that week, the weather finally started to break. I took advantage, going out for a cup of coffee and a mid-morning pastry at the little restaurant 3 doors down from the Rite Aid where Joanna did her last errand. I was sipping and chewing and working the newspaper crossword when someone asked, "Could I share your booth, Mr. Noonan? It's pretty crowded in here today." I looked up and saw an old man that I knew but couldn't quite place. "Ralph Roberts," he said. "I volunteered down at the Red Cross. Me and my wife, Lois." "Oh, okay, sure," I said. "I give blood at the Red Cross every 6 weeks or so. Ralph Roberts was one of the old parties who passed out juice and cookies afterward, telling you not to get up or make any sudden movements if you felt woozy. Please, sit down. He looked at my paper, folded open to the crossword and lying in a patch of sun as he slid into the booth. Don't you find that doing the crossword in the Derry Daily News is sort of like striking out the pitcher in a baseball game? He asked. I laughed and nodded. I do it for the same reason folks climb Mount Everest, Mr. Roberts, because it's there. Only with the news crossword, no one ever falls off. Call me Ralph, please. Okay, and I'm Mike. Good. He grinned, revealing teeth that were crooked and a little yellow, but all his own. I like getting to the first names. It's like being able to take off your tie. It was quite a little cap of wind we had, wasn't it? Yes, I said, but it's warming up nicely now. The thermometer had made one of its nimble March leaps, climbing from 25 degrees last night to 50 this morning. Better than the rise in air temperature, the sun was warm again on your face. It was that warmth that had coaxed me out of the house. Spring will get here, I guess. Some years it gets a little lost, but it always seems to find its way back home. He sipped his coffee, then set the cup down. Haven't seen you at the Red Cross lately. I'm recycling, I said, but that was a fib. I'd come eligible to give another pint 2 weeks ago. The reminder card was up on the refrigerator. It had just slipped my mind. Next week, for sure. I only mention it because I know you're an A, and we can always use that. Save me a couch. Count on it. Everything going all right? I only ask because you look a little tired. If it's insomnia, I can sympathize, believe me. He did have the look of an insomniac, I thought. Too wide around the eyes, somehow. But he was also a man in his mid to late 70s, and I don't think anyone gets that far without showing it. Stick around a little while, and life maybe only jabs at your cheeks and eyes. Stick around a long while, and you end up looking like Jake LaMotta after a hard 15. I opened my mouth to say what I always do when someone asks me if I'm all right, then wondered why I always felt I had to pull that tiresome Marlboro Man shit, just who I thought I was trying to fool. What did I think would happen if I told the guy who gave me a chocolate chip cookie down at the Red Cross after the nurse took the needle out of my arm that I wasn't feeling 100%? Earthquakes? Fire and flood? Shit. No, I said. I really haven't been feeling so great, Ralph. Flu? It's been going around. Nah, the flu missed me this time, actually, and I've been sleeping all right. Which was true. There had been no recurrence of the Sarah Laughs dream in either the normal or the high-octane version. I think I've just got the blues. Well, you ought to take a vacation, he said, then sipped his coffee. When he looked up at me again, he frowned and set his cup down. What, something wrong? No, I thought of saying. You were just the first bird to sing into the silence, Ralph. That's all. No, nothing wrong, I said, and then, because I sort of wanted to see how the words tasted coming out of my own mouth, I repeated them. A vacation. Yeah, he said, smiling. People do it all the time. People do it all the time. He was right about that. Even people who couldn't strictly afford to went on vacation. When they got tired. When they got all balled up in their own shit. When the world was too much with them, getting and spending. I could certainly afford a vacation, and I could certainly take the time off from work. What work, ha-ha? And yet I'd needed the Red Cross cookie man to point out what should have been self-evident to a college-educated guy like me, that I hadn't been on an actual vacation since Joe and I had gone to Bermuda the winter before she died. My particular grindstone was no longer turning, but I had kept my nose to it all the same. It wasn't until that summer, when I read Ralph Roberts's obituary in the news, he was struck by a car, that I fully realized how much I owed him. That advice was better than any glass of orange juice I ever got after giving blood, let me tell you. When I left the restaurant, I didn't go home, but tramped over half the damn town. The section of the newspaper, with the partly completed crossword puzzle in it, clamped under one arm. I walked until I was chilled in spite of the warming temperatures. I didn't think about anything, and yet I thought about everything. It was a special kind of thinking, the sort I'd always done when I was getting close to writing a book, and although I hadn't thought that way in years, I fell into it easily and naturally, as if I had never been away. It's like some guys with a big truck have pulled up in your driveway and are moving things into your basement. I can't explain it any better than that. You can't see what these things are because they're all wrapped up in padded quilts, but you don't need to see them. It's furniture, everything you need to make your house a home, make it just right, just the way you wanted it. When the guys have hopped back into their truck and driven away, you go down to the basement and walk around, the way I went walking around Derry that late morning, slopping uphill and down dale in my old galoshes, touching a padded curve here, a padded angle there. Is this one a sofa? Is that one a dresser? It doesn't matter. Everything is here. The movers didn't forget a thing, and although you'll have to get it all upstairs yourself, straining your poor old back in the process more often than not, that's okay. The important thing is that the delivery was complete. This time I thought, hoped, the delivery truck had brought the stuff I needed for the back 40, the years I might have to spend in a no-writing zone. To the cellar door they had come, and they had knocked politely, and when after several months there was still no answer, they had finally fetched a battering ram. "Hey, buddy, hope the noise didn't scare you too bad. Sorry about the door." I didn't care about the door. I cared about the furniture. Any pieces broken or missing? I didn't think so. I thought all I had to do was get it upstairs, pull off the furniture pads, and put it where it belonged. On my way back home, I passed The Shade, Derry's charming little revival movie house, which has prospered in spite of, or perhaps because of, the video revolution. This month they were showing classic SF from the 50s, but April was dedicated to Humphrey Bogart, Joe's all-time favorite. I stood under the marquee for several moments, studying one of the coming attractions posters. Then I went home, picked a travel agent pretty much at random from the phone book, and told the guy I wanted to go to Key Largo. "Key West, you mean," the guy said. "No," I told him, "I mean Key Largo, just like in the movie with Bogey and Bacall. 3 weeks." Then I rethought that. I was wealthy, I was on my own, and I was retired. What was this 3 weeks shit? "Make it 6," I said. "Find me a cottage or something." "Going to be expensive," he said. I told him I didn't care. When I came back to Derry, it would be spring. In the meantime, I had some furniture to unwrap. I was enchanted with Key Largo for the first month and bored out of my mind for the last 2 weeks. I stayed, though, because boredom is good. People with a high tolerance for boredom can get a lot of thinking done. I ate about 1 billion shrimp, drank about 1,000 margaritas, and read 23 John D. MacDonald novels by actual count. I burned, peeled, and finally tanned. I bought a long-billed cap with parrot head printed on it in bright green thread. I walked the same stretch of beach until I knew everybody by first name. And I unwrapped furniture. A lot of it I didn't like, but there was no doubt that it all fit the house. I thought about Joe and our life together. I thought about saying to her that no one was ever going to confuse being two with Look Homeward, Angel. "You aren't going to pull a lot of frustrated artist crap on me, are you, Noonan?" she had replied. And during my time on Key Largo, those words kept coming back, always in Joe's voice. "Crap. Frustrated artist crap. All that fucking schoolboy frustrated artist crap." I thought about Joe in her long red woods apron, coming to me with a hat full of black trumpet mushrooms, laughing and triumphant. "Nobody on the TR eats better than the Noonans tonight," she'd cried. I thought of her painting her toenails, bent over between her own thighs in the way only women doing that particular piece of business can manage. I thought of her throwing a book at me because I laughed at some new haircut. I thought of her trying to learn how to play a breakdown on her banjo and how she looked braless in a thin sweater. I thought of her crying and laughing and angry. I thought of her telling me it was crap, all that frustrated artist crap. And I thought about the dreams, especially the culminating dream. I could do that easily because it never faded as the more ordinary ones do. The final Sarah Laughs dream and my very first wet dream, coming upon a girl lying naked in a hammock and eating a plum, are the only two that remain perfectly clear to me year after year. The rest are either hazy fragments or completely forgotten. There were a great many clear details to the Sarah dreams. The loons, the crickets, the evening star, and my wish upon it, just to name a few. But I thought most of those things were just verisimilitude, scene setting, if you will. As such, they could be dismissed from my considerations. That left three major elements, three large pieces of furniture to be unwrapped. As I sat on the beach, watching the sun go down between my sandy toes, I didn't think you had to be a shrink to see how those three things went together. In the Sarah dreams, the major elements were the woods behind me, the house below me, and Michael Noonan himself, frozen in the middle. It's getting dark and there's danger in the woods. It will be frightening to go down to the house below, perhaps because it's been empty so long, but I never doubt I must go there. Scary or not, it's the only shelter I have. Except I can't do it. I can't move. I've got writer's walk. In the nightmare, I am finally able to go toward shelter, only the shelter proves false. Proves more dangerous than I had ever expected in my, well, yes, in my wildest dreams. My dead wife rushes out, screaming and still tangled in her shroud, to attack me. Even 5 weeks later, and almost 3,000 miles from Derry, remembering that speedy white thing with its baggy arms would make me shiver and look back over my shoulder. But was it Joanna? I didn't really know, did I? The thing was all wrapped up. The coffin looked like the one in which she had been buried, true, but that might just be misdirection. Writer's walk? Writer's block. I can't write, I told the voice in the dream. The voice says I can. The voice says the writer's block is gone, and I believe it because the writer's walk is gone. I'm finally headed down the driveway, going to shelter. I'm afraid, though. Even before the shapeless white thing makes its appearance, I'm terrified. I say it's Mrs. Danvers I'm afraid of, but that's just my dreaming mind getting Sarah Laughs and Manderley all mixed up. I'm afraid of writing, I heard myself saying out loud. I'm afraid to even try. This was the night before I finally flew back to Maine, and I was half-past sober, going on drunk. By the end of my vacation, I was drinking a lot of evenings. It's not the block that scares me, it's undoing the block. I'm really fucked, boys and girls. I'm fucked big time. Fucked or not, I had an idea I'd finally reached the heart of the matter. I was afraid of undoing the block, maybe afraid of picking up the strands of my life and going on without Joe. Yet some deep part of my mind believed I must do it. That's what the menacing noises behind me in the woods were about. And belief counts for a lot. Too much, maybe, especially if you're imaginative. When an imaginative person gets into mental trouble, the line between seeming and being has a way of disappearing. Things in the woods, yes, sir. I had one of them right there in my hand as I was thinking these things. I lifted my drink, holding it toward the western sky so that the setting sun seemed to be burning in the glass. I was drinking a lot, and maybe that was okay on Key Largo. Hell, people were supposed to drink a lot on vacation. It was almost the law. But I'd been drinking too much even before I left. The kind of drinking that could get out of hand in no time at all. The kind that could get a man into trouble. Things in the woods, and the potentially safe place guarded by a scary bugbear that was not my wife, but perhaps my wife's memory. It made sense, because Sarah Laughs had always been Joe's favorite place on earth. That thought led to another, one that made me swing my legs over the side of the chaise I'd been reclining on and sit up in excitement. Sarah Laughs had also been the place where the ritual had begun. Champagne, last line, and the all-important benediction. Well then, that's all right, isn't it? Did I want things to be all right again? Did I truly want that? A month or a year before, I mightn't have been sure, but now I was. The answer was yes. I wanted to move on, let go of my dead wife, rehab my heart, move on. But to do that, I'd have to go back. Back to the log house. Back to Sarah Laughs. Yeah, I said, and my body broke out in goose flesh. Yeah, you got it. So why not? The question made me feel as stupid as Ralph Roberts' observation that I needed a vacation. If I needed to go back to Sarah Laughs now that my vacation was over, indeed, why not? It might be a little scary the first night or two, a hangover from my final dream, but just being there might dissolve the dream faster. And this last thought I allowed in only one humble corner of my conscious mind. Something might happen with my writing. It wasn't likely, but it wasn't impossible either. Barring a miracle, hadn't that been my thought on New Year's Day as I sat on the rim of the tub holding a damp washcloth to the cut on my forehead? Yes. Barring a miracle. Sometimes blind people fall down, knock their heads, and regain their sight. Sometimes maybe cripples are able to throw their crutches away when they get to the top of the church steps. I had 8 or 9 months before Harold and Deborah started really bugging me for the next novel. I decided to spend the time at Sarah Laughs. It would take me a little while to tie things up in Derry, and a while for Bill Dean to get the house on the lake ready for a year-round resident, but I could be down there by the 4th of July easily. I decided that was a good date to shoot for, not just the birthday of our country, but pretty much the end of bug season in western Maine. By the day I packed up my vacation gear, the John D. MacDonald paperbacks I left for the cabin's next inhabitant, shaved a week's worth of stubble off a face so tanned it no longer looked like my own to me, and flew back to Maine, I was decided. I'd go back to the place my subconscious mind had identified as shelter against the deepening dark. I'd go back even though my mind had also suggested that doing so would not be without risks. I would not go back expecting Sarah to be Lourdes, but I would allow myself to hope. And when I saw the evening star peeping out over the lake for the first time, I would allow myself to wish on it. Only one thing didn't fit into my neat deconstruction of the Sarah dreams, and because I couldn't explain it, I tried to ignore it. I didn't have much luck, though. Part of me was still a writer, I guess, and a writer is a man who has taught his mind to misbehave. It was the cut on the back of my hand. That cut had been in all the dreams. I would swear it had. And then it had actually appeared. You didn't get that sort of shit in the works of Dr. Freud. Stuff like that was strictly for the psychic friend's hotline. It was a coincidence, that's all, I thought as my plane started its descent. I was in seat A2. The nice thing about flying up front is that if the plane goes down, you're first to the crash site. And looking at pine forests as we slipped along the glide path toward Bangor International Airport. The snow was gone for another year. I had vacationed it to death. Only coincidence. How many times have you cut your hands in your life? I mean, they're always out front, aren't they? Waving themselves around, practically begging for it. All that should have rung true, and yet somehow it didn't, quite. It should have, but, well, it was the boys in the basement. They were the ones who didn't buy it. The boys in the basement didn't buy it at all. At that point, there was a thump as the 737 touched down, and I put the whole line of thought out of my mind. One afternoon, shortly after arriving back home, I rummaged the closets until I found the shoeboxes containing Joe's old photographs. I sorted them, then studied my way through the ones of Dark Score Lake. There were a staggering number of these, but because Joanna was the shutterbug, there weren't many with her in them. I found one, though, that I remembered taking in 1990 or 91. Sometimes even an untalented photographer can take a good picture. If 700 monkeys spent 700 years bashing away at 700 typewriters and all that. And this was good. In it, Joe was standing on the float with the sun going down, red gold behind her. She was just out of the water, dripping wet, wearing a two-piece swimming suit, gray with red piping. I had caught her laughing and brushing her soaked hair back from her forehead and temples. Her nipples were very prominent against the cups of her halter. She looked like an actress on a movie poster for one of those guilty pleasure B-pictures about monsters at Party Beach or a serial killer stalking the campus. I was sucker-punched by a sudden, powerful lust for her. I wanted her upstairs, just as she was in that photograph, with strands of her hair pasted to her cheeks and that wet bathing suit clinging to her. I wanted to suck her nipples through the halter top, taste the cloth and feel their hardness through it. I wanted to suck water out of the cotton like milk, then yank the bottom of her suit off and fuck her until we both exploded. Hands shaking a little, I put the photograph aside with some others I liked, although there were no others I liked in quite that same way. I had a huge hard-on, one of those ones that feel like stone covered with skin. Get one of those, and until it goes away, you are good for nothing. The quickest way to solve a problem like that, when there's no woman around willing to help you solve it, is to masturbate. But that time, the idea never even crossed my mind. Instead, I walked restlessly through the upstairs rooms of my house with my fists opening and closing in what looked like a hood ornament stuffed down the front of my jeans. Anger may be a normal part of the grieving process. I've read that it is. But I was never angry at Joanna in the wake of her death until the day I found that picture. Then, wow. There I was, walking around with a boner that just wouldn't quit, furious with her. Stupid bitch, why had she been running on one of the hottest days of the year? Stupid, inconsiderate bitch to leave me alone like this, not even able to work. I sat down on the stairs and wondered what I should do. A drink was what I should do, I decided, and then maybe another drink to scratch the first one's back. I actually got up before deciding that wasn't a very good idea at all. I went into my office instead, turned on the computer, and did a crossword puzzle. That night when I went to bed, I thought of looking at the picture of Joe in her bikini again. I decided that was almost as bad an idea as a few drinks when I was feeling angry and depressed. But I'll have the dream tonight, I thought as I turned off the light. I'll have the dream for sure. I didn't, though. My dreams of Sarah Laff seemed to be finished.